Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young. Jeremy Hobson is off today. This is Here and Now. And the Scottish minister, the head of the Scottish government, who also led the effort to make Scotland independent from the UK, is stepping down. Alex Salmond says he will resign following yesterday's no vote on independence.
I think the party, parliament and country would benefit from new leadership. Therefore, I've told the National Secretary of the Scottish National Party that I shall not accept nomination for leader at the annual conference in Perth on the 13th to the 15th of November. After the membership ballot, I'll stand down as First Minister to allow the new leader to be elected by due parliamentary process.
In the end, 55% of Scottish voters said they wanted to keep the 307-year-old union with the UK. Earlier today, British Prime Minister David Cameron had this to say about the vote.
The people of Scotland have spoken. And it is a clear result. They have kept our country of four nations together. And like millions of other people, I am delighted. As I said during the campaign, it would have broken my heart to see our United Kingdom come to an end.
NPR's Ari Shapiro is in Edinburgh. And Ari, Salmond stepping down. Is this a surprise?
Well, I wouldn't say that people expected it, but certainly many speculated that if the independence referendum did not go the Scottish National Party's way, that Salmond would be likely to resign. The flip side of that argument is that he really moved Scotland far closer to independence than anyone previously had, and arguably moved the SNP from a fringe party to a major political force that got global attention. After this vote, there is now going to be a big negotiation with the main parties in London about what kinds of powers Scotland will have. And it's possible that facing that, he just didn't think he had the credibility and power to have that kind of a negotiation after having lost this referendum.
You know, the sense that he lost the vote, so he maybe lost some power in that negotiation. But some would say he won this incredible legacy of getting Britain to gain these powers. And remind us, this is a fellow, along with his party, he was considered fringe. The party was considered fringe at one time with this idea of independence.
Absolutely. He became First Minister in 2007 when the idea of Scottish independence seemed far off, and the Scottish National Party was a party that nobody really took seriously. Then in 2011, the party took the majority of the Scottish Parliament, and suddenly he was leading the charge for this independence referendum, which, while it did not pass, came closer than ever before in the 300-plus years of Scottish history with the union with England.
Yeah, but not quite close enough, 55 to something like 45. A wider spread than any of the polls showed going in. What happened?
You're right that the polls had shown a 20-point gap with unity in the lead for a very long time, and then just before the vote, the polls tightened really, really closely. Going into the vote, they showed a near tie, so the polls were clearly off. What we can say, based on what we know of the vote, is that older people were much more likely to vote for unity, keeping Scotland in the United Kingdom. Women were much more likely to vote for unity. Men were more likely to vote for independence. Working class voters were more likely to vote yes for independence, whereas wealthier voters were more likely to vote to stay in the United Kingdom.
Yeah. So who is likely to replace Alex Salmond?
Nicola Sturgeon, his deputy, seems like the most likely candidate. She has been by his side through this whole campaign and, is sort of the next in line within the party. I don't think there is a sense that the party needs an overhaul. Many would say the party is more relevant than ever. It's just that they lost this very important referendum last night.
Yeah. And what is it like there on the streets now? It is the day after. And, half the country just about, or a little more than half, won, half lost. What's the feeling there?
Well, the yes campaign was always sort of the more vocal, the more active, the ones that were putting stickers on things, putting chalk slogans on things, waving the flags. Although the no campaign was active as well, I think the yes campaign is feeling a little deflated, and the no campaign might just be catching up on sleep because it was a very long night. The results didn't start coming in until well after midnight, and the sun was up by the time that we actually knew the outcome.
Yeah. So maybe some healing there in Scotland after this really, intense vote. But also a lot of independent-minded people across Europe in Catalonia, in Spain, the Flemish in Belgium, were watching, and some watching closely. Some had sent delegations there.
That's right. Last night, we were at the Foreign Media Center where the count was taking place, and there was a number of people from Catalonia, both government officials and journalists, who saw this as an example that they would like to follow, even though the independence referendum did not pass. Just the fact that the people of Scotland were able to go to the polls, cast a vote, and determine how they wished to be governed was, as you say, really an inspiration for independence movements not only in Europe but around the world.
Yeah. And so what do they take from this? Again, you know, inspiration, but, you know, do you think it will lead to things? What's the speculation there in Scotland? Have they triggered other movements?
Well, as recently as this Monday and as recently as this morning, in fact, David Cameron said, this will not be the same as it was. Scotland will have more power and autonomy on matters ranging from taxes to spending to welfare. And so now everyone has to get together and hammer out the details of what that autonomy looks like. That's going to be this tug of war that I mentioned earlier, both between the parties in London and between London and Scotland. David Cameron has also said he wishes to extend autonomy to Wales, Northern Ireland. That's all going to be hammered out in the months ahead.
And Ari Shapiro, one thing we talked earlier today, and we were saying that another thing that has definitely happened for Scotland is people have remembered it, perhaps, and seen this beautiful, feisty, wonderful country. And I'm sure there's going to be a tourist influx as well.
Perhaps so, yeah.
Yeah. NPR's Ari Shapiro already there in Edinburgh. Thanks so much.
Good to talk with you, Robin.
You too. Let's bring in Tasmina Ahmed Sheikh. She worked closely with Alex Salmon on the Yes campaign. As we said, he's now stepping down. She's also the National Women's Officer for the SNP, his party, the Scottish National Party. We spoke to her just before Salmon's resignation or announcement of his resignation. And even though her side lost, she was pretty upbeat.
It's an exciting day. It's an exciting day for Scotland because at the end of the day, Yes Scotland ran a grassroots campaign, and as a result of which we have engaged and enthused members of the voting public who have not been interested in politics at all. There are people exercising their votes yesterday who are in the age of 60 and above who've never voted before in their lifetime. So I would say, and our feeling is, that the result, of course, is disappointing. We wanted to win independence for Scotland, but there are so many plus sides, and it's a win-win situation for Scotland, whereby we have an energised and enthused populace now who are interested in politics. So from that perspective, it's been great. And the turnout, as you may have reported, Robin, I've not had the benefit of your report, in excess of 80%, unprecedented in any UK election.
Well, you also have won promises from Prime Minister David Cameron. What do you expect from him and will you demand from him?
You know, the interesting thing, Robin, is we've been campaigning for independence in this campaign, once we had the referendum date, for in excess of 2.5 years. What we saw in the last 2 weeks of this campaign was a panic-stricken Westminster government who felt they absolutely had to come up with something to make sure that they didn't lose Scotland. And what we saw as a result of that was a panic-stricken powers, which haven't yet been defined as exactly what those powers are going to be. Pronouncements from Westminster, promises of further powers. Within minutes of those further powers being promised, we had backbench MPs at Westminster saying, well, actually, we're not going to support extra powers for Scotland. So they've got themselves in a bit of a mess in that respect. However, it is a promise that they have made to the people of Scotland, and they will be held to account in terms of that promise, because he said, don't vote yes, vote no, because voting no is not the status quo. Voting no means change. And they also gave us a timetable for that change. So, Rob, absolutely, starting from when the vote was declared yesterday, we will be and will continue to hold Westminster government to account and make sure that the people of Scotland are not let down and disappointed as a result of false promises.
Well, for people who haven't been following this closely, what are the kinds of, can you be more specific? We've heard about taxes and more representation. What are the kinds of things you want?
Well, you know, Robin, I can't be more specific because there is no agreement between the London political parties as to what these extra powers might be from within their own party, let alone between the political parties. So it's kind of a woolly promise of power over more issues. Now, from a Scottish perspective, what we're saying is, well, we don't want power in terms of certain issues. We want the normal state of being for a nation, which is to have control over everything that affects our daily lives. It's not just about raising your taxes. It's about having power to spend the revenue that you get from taxation, which is clearly important. And that allows us to tackle things that are of great importance to the people of Scotland. And one of the reasons why so many people living in deprived areas of Scotland voted yes. You may well be aware that Glasgow, the highest, biggest populated city in Glasgow, voted resoundingly for yes. And that is because this is a city facing poverty. One in four children are living in poverty. We have an exponential rise in the use of food banks. And this has to change. And it simply hasn't been possible under the continuing political union with the United Kingdom. We can only hope, because it is incumbent upon us to accept the democratic will of the people of Scotland. And they have spoken. And they're overwhelming their decision in terms of a 55-45 vote is that we have to retain our position within the union.
Well, let me play the part of those backbenchers, those who were against giving Scotland more powers. Scotland, although it has shown itself to be very powerful in the last 2 weeks, is a very small part of the United Kingdom percentage-wise. Why should people in the much larger area of Britain acquiesce to the demands?
Well, you know, I don't think it's a consideration of size at all. I think it's about, you know, whether, A, you are a nation, and Scotland is undoubtedly a nation. We had independence before we had the union. It's about, you know, we have devolution in a number of matters, and we've been able to be very innovative in our use of devolution. So, for instance, we have devolution in relation to health and education. In terms of education, there are no student tuition fees in Scotland, because we believe that is a commitment we should make to our young people, that they should be able to study for free and then contribute back. But independence would allow us the powers to do everything. Now, in terms of these backbench MPs, well, they're going to have to listen to the people of Scotland, because it's a promise that they have made. And whether we're 5 million people or 500,000 people, you know, Robin, I'm going to give you just a few figures. We have 20% of the entire EU fish stocks, 25% of the entire European Union renewable energy potential, and 60% of the oil revenue, oil fields, in terms of the whole of the European Union. That's massive. Our contribution is huge. We should be a big player on the international stage. Now, maybe our time hasn't yet come in terms of independence, but the journey of home rule is one that we are well and truly on, and this is just the beginning.
Well, I was going to say the other thing you have is the world's attention. Tasmina Ahmed Sheikh, a member of the Yes Scotland Advisory Board, but of course they lost in yesterday's vote for independence. But as we're hearing, this doesn't sound like a loser. Tasmina, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Robin.
The Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba is having its Wall Street debut today with the largest IPO, initial public offering, in U.S. history, and a stock price making Alibaba more valuable than Amazon or eBay. And with the strong interest from investors, there's also concern about Alibaba's business, how the company's structured. So let's bring in Zoe Chase with NPR's Planet Money team in New York following this offering. First of all, Zoe, how's it going for them?
Hi. Well, it's been kind of an exciting morning if you're just watching this one story, because it took a long time for trading to start because there was so much interest in buying and selling Alibaba that the way it works is there's actually one guy on the floor of the stock exchange that has to measure the kind of supply and demand coming in around it. So it took a while for him to kind of figure out what should be the opening price. It was $92.70, way above what they thought it was going to be. And then it shot right up to 100 as soon as it started trading. And now it seems to be back around 92. And it's been like that for a little bit.
Well, we know how long it took because we thought we'd have nothing to talk to you about. That's okay. But just remind people, this is an IPO. So this means that this was a private company. And now this is a chance for investors and individuals to jump in and be a part of it, buy a part of it.
Yeah. I mean, Alibaba's a huge company. It's a massively successful Chinese e-commerce company. And now this is a point where basically it's selling shares of itself. It's selling little pieces of the company to the public. And so that means that, you know, people who are buying shares of the company will get sort of a slice of the profits. They could also lose if Alibaba crashes and burns. But it's a way to raise a bunch of money if the company wants to expand or invest in some way. And then, of course, something nice can happen for the people who own stock, which is occasionally a big company will pay out a dividend, pay out just a big chunk of the profits that they're making. And so investors can make a little bit of money.
But what are some of the concerns? Because we've been hearing that there are concerns.
Yeah. Alibaba, so the way it works with Chinese internet companies is they actually, the rule in China is that there's no foreign money allowed to be invested in a Chinese internet company, which is a problem if you're something like Alibaba that wants a bunch of foreign money, as we can see. So what they've had to do and what a lot of other Chinese internet companies have done is set up this other company called Alibaba Group Holding. It's based in the Cayman Islands, and that's actually the company that is going public on the stock exchange today, not the group of websites that's based in China. And it's this sort of other holding company that, you know, a bunch of the profits supposedly from the Alibaba in China go into this one in the Cayman Islands. And there's all these contractual relationships to show that owning a share of the Cayman Islands company is just like owning a share of the Chinese company. But it's a little bit of an unusual arrangement, and it can spook some traditional investors who are used to owning a share of the company means you own a share of the company. That's not quite how it works here.
Yeah. Well, what about the company itself? We got about a minute here. We know it's slightly different from eBay and Amazon, but so how is Silicon Valley looking at this? Are they excited, or is this seen as, oh my gosh, a competitor that's going to, you know, eat eBay's shorts?
I think the answer is both of those. Yes, it could totally eat eBay's shorts. eBay is a direct competitor, and this is a way bigger company than eBay. However, it's another huge company that can potentially make acquisitions. So Alibaba was looking at Snapchat and was valuing Snapchat for some crazy amount of money, something like $100 million, which is just like a, you know, a little picture-taking company for your mobile phone. And basically, Facebook and Google and these other big tech companies, they buy littler companies in Silicon Valley and make those littler companies a ton of money. Now we have a new player on the scene. That's just more money coming into Silicon Valley, coming into these, you know, entrepreneurs that are starting these little companies, hoping for a big payout. And that's what could happen now that Alibaba's on the scene.
Zoe Chase of NPR's Planet Money team. I picture you all with sort of sweatshirts with that name on it. Zoe, thanks so much.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
You too. Well, now we want to turn to the Ebola crisis. Astonishing stories from West Africa. Thousands of healthcare workers in Sierra Leone are knocking on doors and looking for hidden cases of Ebola as that country begins a three-day lockdown of 6 million residents. Some experts worry that the plan could backfire, as it did in Guinea earlier this week, when villagers attacked and killed 8 people on an Ebola awareness mission because they feared the workers were sent to spread Ebola. Meanwhile, here in the U.S., nonprofit groups are sending experts and resources to the area. Project Cure is one of the largest providers in the world of donated medical supplies and equipment. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Colorado Public Radio's John Daly visited their warehouse just south of Denver as volunteers packed up the latest shipments bound for Africa.
A forklift wheels a pallet full of boxes into a 40-foot shipping container. These medical supplies are headed for Sierra Leone. It's been hit hard by Ebola. Project Cure CEO Douglas Jackson says the boxes hold the usual suspects: gloves, masks, gowns, tubes, and bandages, as well as some unexpected items like duct tape.
Some of our friends in Congo, the last time we went through this, said, you know what you could send to us that would be really, really effective? And I said, what? And he said, well, duct tape. And I'm like, wait. You mean like duct tape? You know, the stuff I hang pictures with? Are you kidding?
Duct tape is critical because Ebola spreads through direct contact with bodily fluids and blood. Communications Director Jan Mazzotti says the tape seals gaps in protective gear.
It's about how do you tape your gloves onto your hands so it doesn't get in there? How do you tape your goggles to your face so that it doesn't come through where your temples hit the goggle and it's not quite sealed?
Project Cure teams travel the globe, having established partnerships in more than 130 countries. A year and a half ago, Jackson visited Sierra Leone before the outbreak.
All the doctors and nurses that I was working with up in Kanama are dead because they came in contact with, you know, blood and sweat and stuff from the people who were sick, and they caught the disease and they died. So all of the stuff that we're sending right now is the stuff designed to create a protective barrier between that healthcare worker and the people who are sick.
Last year, Project Cure shipped containers with $55 million worth of medical supplies around the world. The supplies are donated by hospitals, manufacturers, distributors, and individuals. They are in perfectly good condition, but maybe came from a dented box, or they just aren't needed anymore, like a stack of old crutches. Corinne Damahidi, who directs Project Cure's overseas clinics, stands in the middle of the warehouse, which is bigger than a football field.
I look around and every single thing you see here would have ended up in the landfill.
Many items have exceeded a federally mandated expiration date, but Communications Director Jan Mazzotti says there's nothing wrong with them.
Band-Aids don't go bad. Gloves don't go bad. Tubing doesn't go bad.
82, 84.
Volunteer coordinator Millie Truitt helps oversee the sorting and packing of boxes. She says as the Ebola crisis has worsened, they're working as hard as ever.
Oh, yes. Yes, we're busy. And that's good. That's what we're here for. We feel very blessed to be able to do this.
With the number of Ebola cases now on the rise, the shipment of donated medical supplies and a roll or two of duct tape couldn't arrive at a more critical time. For Here and Now, I'm John Daly.
And overnight, France began airstrikes against ISIS militants in Iraq, joining the U.S. coalition, which also plans to strike ISIS in Syria. The BBC Middle East editor Jeremy Bowen traveled to that front line south of Damascus.
The latest government offensive around Damascus seems to have stalled. Nothing new in that, but this war is changing. The Syrian Air Force has had the sky to itself, but now the Americans are threatening to turn their air power on Syria as well as Iraq. That was the Syrians, but the Americans came very close to bombing the Assad regime a year ago. Now President Obama says they'll hit Islamic State positions in Syria if necessary. The intervention of America and its allies, perhaps including Britain, will only be aimed at first anyway, one part of the war that is destroying Syria and Iraq. But it will force every other part of it into a new, much less predictable shape. The Syrian army let us visit the front line at Ain Bida, a village about 20 minutes' drive south of Damascus. It was recaptured recently by the Syrian army. Most of the village has been flattened. Najm was helping out at Ain Bida's only shop.
The children get scared from the sounds, especially when there is heavy fighting. It's safe now that the army is here.
And what's the future for your kids?
They don't have a bright future. We are moving from one place to another. I have been displaced 5 times. What future do you think they will have?
We went to a small army outpost, a single-story concrete building on the front line, protected by sandbags, oil drums full of earth, around a dozen Syrian soldiers and a tank.
The Syrian government says that any move against Islamic State or another jihadi group without their men is not going to work because their soldiers are well-armed, they're trained, they're battle-hardened, and they're already in the field fighting every day.
But the Americans and the British have said that cooperation is impossible since they want the Assad regime to go. Not long after we arrived, a firefight with rebels 300 metres away started. The government soldiers at Ain Bida were shooting at the Free Syria Army, which the Americans want to train to fight Islamic State. But the FSA's allies here are the Nusra Front, which is an al-Qaeda affiliate. Finding clients they can trust will be hard for the Americans in Syria, which might make it more likely they'd be forced to use their own troops. The Syrian soldiers said the West was only now catching up with their belief that there's a war of survival here against religious extremists. The general commanding the sector, like all the soldiers, didn't want to be named. He said America was responsible for Islamic State and its talk of intervention was another attempt to overthrow President Assad.
Islamic State is a threat on the whole world. But as a military power, they're not a threat. Syria can crush them without the help of the Americans.
The rebels and their supporters believe the Syrian army is the tool of a brutal dictator. But the tangled politics of the Syrian war are changing, getting more complicated, more bloody. Plenty of Syrians who support the Assad regime believe that one day the West will accept its offer of help against Islamic State.
The BBC's Jeremy Bowen, here and now. More than 120 heads of state will meet next week in New York for the UN Climate Summit, the largest gathering of world leaders ever on climate. But before that, on Sunday, up to 100,000 climate change activists, from environmentalists to faith groups to labor groups, plan to march through Manhattan in one of the largest ever climate demonstrations to send a message to those leaders. Karthikeya Singh is a researcher with the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts. He's also worked on climate negotiations, including consulting for the waterlogged Maldives. And Karthikeya, you write about a line that you overheard at a particularly heated negotiation. It had to do with the text of an agreement that was being proposed. And someone said, if we accept this text, we are killing ourselves. Tell us more about that and how that informed you.
Yeah, that was actually one of the final meetings at the Durban climate change negotiations back in 2012. And it was really coming down to what sort of framework is acceptable to the Association of Small Island States. And it was not seeming fair to many members of that grouping and did not seem ambitious enough. And rightly so. You know, we are not at a place where we can say that the climate will stabilize to below 2 degrees, which scientists believe will be safer for life on our planet. And so accepting any text that looked like it was going to far overshoot this would threaten essentially the livelihoods and the sovereignty of many of these small island states.
Well, in their very existence, some people might remember, you know, when the Maldives president held a cabinet meeting underwater.
That is correct. And that was intended to send precisely that kind of message, that this is not just about making political statements at an international level and declarations that will not be met and that governments must deliver in earnest. Otherwise, literally, nations will be wiped out and we'll have climate refugees. And where will they go?
Well, and now you train diplomats from countries who participate in these climate negotiations. What do you tell them?
In the trainings that I have been involved in, there are very specific roles that I have played in the past. And one is sort of what are the options technologically to address the issue? And then the other side of it, the more nitty-gritty of the negotiations that I can most recently speak to from my experience of training in Qatar prior to the negotiations that happened there, was how to navigate the complex negotiating process, particularly for first-time diplomats who are engaging in what is a decades-long process that is incredibly complex. I mean, we're talking about you arrive at a negotiation, there's various working groups late into the night, negotiation happening both formally and informally, where to get your documents, how to leverage social media and civil society. These are the kinds of things that I was able to contribute in the trainings to first-time diplomats based on my own various experiences, both as an academic and as an activist and also as a negotiator in the process.
So those are perhaps thoughts ahead of the meeting of heads of state on Tuesday, but you're also heading to the demonstration on Sunday. What point do you want to get across there?
I want to go primarily because many social movements have big moments of gathering, of turning points. You know, recently the Yale Project on Climate Communication released a survey of registered voters in the United States about how many of them would be willing to vote for candidates that support climate change legislation. And given that we even have elections coming up in this country, the importance of such gatherings in sending a signal to politicians that we are watching. We do care about this as an important issue. Of course, the economy matters and other matters of global diplomacy and security do matter, but climate change is a security issue. And so I want to go and witness what I believe will be a historic event and that can be a turning point towards informing politicians that this is an important issue that they should focus on. And of course, I'm going representing many different voices. The voice of the Indian Youth Climate Network that I, along with others, founded back in March 2008 while I was living in India, and various other groups that cannot be here.
And you say you want to fly the Indian flag. Remind us what's at stake for India.
Well, India is, according to certain vulnerability indexes that are coming out, one of the most vulnerable. The monsoon, which India relies so heavily on, is becoming increasingly erratic. And the entire nation and the region's water supply depends on this annual event. And with it becoming threatened, the livelihoods of hundreds of millions of people is on the line. And at the same time, India struggles because it does not have energy access. 400 million people do not have electricity access in India. So how India chooses to bring power to these people will not only have implications domestically, but also globally.
Well, in fact, you are looking to bring solar power to areas that are right now in the dark. But the observation has been made that this is terrific, you know, solar energy coming to India, but it's people largely moving from no energy to solar energy, not people moving off fossil fuels. And you know that Americans can get kind of resistant to doing a lot of change until these behemoths that are just starting up their use of fossil fuels in some ways, India and China, until they do something.
Yeah, and I think it's very important to understand, and I think about myself trying to be a bridge between two countries, what it's like to understand the other side. And, you know, my own ancestral village on the outskirts of Jodhpur, Rajasthan, we only recently received electricity access. I just went back there recently. And before we had that, people had purchased solar panels. And so I think people need to understand, you know, what that number is of people that are living in the dark and what it means to come out of that kind of energy poverty, and then what it means for us to point the finger from this side and ask for more when there's so little already existing. And at the same time, when we get to these international climate negotiations and there is a constant call for more funds for the developing countries, I think it's also important to understand that even from a diplomatic perspective, we are constrained politically here in the United States by what is feasible and how much more can we squeeze at this time when the right policies aren't in place to allow the flow of capital for the needs of the Global South.
Well, meanwhile, so we have this meeting of heads of state on Tuesday. It is part of a build-up to the meeting in Peru in a few months and then Paris next year. Outline how important those are.
I think we need to keep the momentum going, and that's the primary purpose of this summit. Unless we build that momentum, we may not arrive in Paris by 2015 with a workable document that negotiators can get to work on and finalize. And so that is what this summit will do, is hopefully have political declarations that are ambitious. There might be some surprises. There might not be many surprises from some of the bigger players. And then Peru will certainly have to deliver in terms of finalizing the working pieces before Paris.
That's Karthike Singh, researcher with the Center for International Environment and Resource Policy at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And it's Friday when we go on stage to look at what's happening on the boards across the country, from poetry slams to, today, dance festivals. That's the Black Ice Step Team of the College of New Rochelle in New York at that school's Straw Fest. Before that, we heard a dance performance at the Yuma Hip Hop Festival in Yuma, Arizona, and to start, the Irish Dance Festival in New York City. And now, let's go to Hoop Camp. They call themselves the largest yearly gathering of the hoop dance community. It's being held next week in the Tibetan Retreat Center in Santa Cruz, California. Hoop Camp is in its seventh year. It was started by Heather Troy, who has a hoop troupe called the Hoopalites, and she joins us now. And Heather, many of us know people who hoop, dancing with hula hoops and specialized hoops. Describe it more. What is this?
It's a wonderful tool for personal transformation. We call ourselves hoopers, and we share all the joy and health and fitness and empowerment and community and fun that hooping brings into people's lives.
Stay with the fitness part. This is hard. This isn't, you know, the way we used to hula hoop in the driveway. This started about 10 years ago after the jam band, the String Cheese Incident, started throwing out hoops at their concerts. But these are traditional hula hoops along with hoops, heavier hoops made with irrigation tubing. Why is that better?
These hoops are slightly weighted and larger, so they're actually easier to spin. So the movement that started with the string cheese throwing out hoops to the crowd was picked up by a few key people in the hoop movement. Anna Reichenbach of Hoop Revolution really started the movement, and she started teaching all these new tricks and moves. Mm-hmm. They now also have LED hoops, so hoops with lights in them. So it's become a whole movement of people, almost like a cottage industry of people making their own hoops in their communities with this irrigation tubing and sparkle tape. And
well, and the choreography is amazing. We have a performance from last year's hoop camp, and we'll have this at herenow.org. This is hooper Matthew Peretta. Let's listen. What we're seeing in the upper body strength is just incredible. He has four hoops. They are going different ways. Now they look like butterfly wings. Now they look like torches. They're going so fast. He's hooping with his head. I mean, the strength is incredible. It's quite something. It's being called part of the flow arts movement. You call yourselves play professionals. What does it feel like when you're doing it?
It's actually a wonderful feeling. It really gets you into the present moment. It's almost like a drum beat on your body. So you feel very empowered as you spin and move and flow with this movement tool.
I have a former sister-in-law who apparently is in your community.
Yes.
Sass, Sandy Schwartz. I mean, I've seen her do this. It's stunning. But how is it different from arrhythmia? Oh, you know, we've seen the Olympic athletes who use hoops and balls and streamers. How's this different from that?
It's very much a grassroots movement of people embracing this type of hoop that is made out of irrigation tubing, but very similar in that a lot of the moves and tricks take a bit of training and practice. So like the rhythmic gymnastics who are training for the Olympics, we hoopers are just training because we want to learn all these new moves and we want to share it with people. And there is a website called hooping.org that started by Hooper Philo, where the community meets, where there's move shares, trick shares. Everyone's coming up with these amazing new moves to share with people. And so there's lots of videos out there.
Well, for instance, before we let you go, we know one of the events at Hoop Camp coming up is a twerking unicorn relay race. What is that?
Yes. That is part of the play that hoopers enjoy. It is a move where you actually bend at the waist with your arms on the ground, and you do a twerk move, and you move forward with it. And so we are going to have a very fun twerking unicorn race at Hoop Camp this year.
There is no hoop involved in that.
Yes, there is a hoop. The hoop is around your waist. So you're leaning forward and moving, twerking and moving like a horse / unicorn.
And so hooping at the same
hooping.
Time.
Yes.
It's something. Again, we'll have pictures at herenow.org and information about Hoop Camp coming up next week. Heather Troy, who's the organizer, have fun.
Thank you so much.
But now we want to go to music and what it can do to the mind. A study published this month in the Journal of Neuroscience looks at free music programs aimed at at-risk kids and finds that studying music improves performance in the brain. Youth Radio Scott Lau went through a similar program. He's now a freshman at the University of Southern California studying the music business and the cello. And he sent us this audio postcard about how playing the cello changed him.
I'm Scott Lau, I'm 17 years old, and I've been playing the cello for 7 years. I think that's A. Is that an A? Hold up, let me check. In middle school, I had the option of doing PE or orchestra, and I did orchestra instead. And I really wanted to play the violin, but it was first come, first serve, and everyone else chose the violin, so I ended up playing the cello. Basically, the violin is the diva of the orchestra, and I'm not that person. Sometimes it's nice to be in the background and not have all its attention focused on you.
Mm-hmm.
The notes in Pachelbel's canon, it's the same five notes over and over again. It's D, A, B, F sharp, and then G. The violins, the second violins, and even the violas have this beautiful melody that people play at their weddings, at graduations, and that melody never gets passed to the cellos, and we're playing the same five notes over and over. And sometimes it's frustrating being in the background, but that's just the role that you have to play sometimes. You really have to be in tune with the main melody and make sure you're not overpowering them. Listen. I connect personally with the cello because a lot of times I find that I'm in the background in class, in conversations with friends or at work. I only interject my ideas and my comments every once in a while. I'm kind of, in a way, harmonizing with what other people are saying rather than going out of my way and trying to steal the spotlight in the conversation. I don't get to be the star of the show, but I don't always have to be, because even though you won't notice my sound when it's there, you'll definitely notice it when it's gone.
Scott Lau's story from Youth Radio. And we do notice when it's gone and we don't like it. Here he performs the prelude from Bach's Cello Suite No. 1. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. Feel better, Jeremy? This is Here and Now.